tells a story told to her by a friend, things can get complicated.
That feeling that people have about you when they know that you're a writer, it's very different from if they think you might be a writer. I had to go through that for, you know, when I first started to write. The assumption is that you will fail. But once they find out that you actually are a writer, then their relationship is never, their feelings, I think, are never quite as relaxed as they would be if they didn't fear that you might write something about them.
Hmm. And even more so if you write a memoir, I would think.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk to memoir writers. That's just too close, right? You know you're going to wind up in there.
That's Valerie Martin. She tells us about her new novel, I Give It to You. It's a many-layered tale about what happens when an Italian friend tells a writer a story about her family in Mussolini's Italy. But first, we talk with graphic artist Joe Lee about his stunningly illustrated book, Forgiveness, the story of Eva Kaur, survivor of the Auschwitz twin experiments.
When one of the SS soldiers asked if the two girls who were dressed identically and looked identical, if they were twins, her mother said, well, is that a good thing? Ask that. And he said, yes. And that is the only thing that kept them from being instantly taken to the gas chambers.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Eva Moses Kaur was liberated from the Auschwitz death camp in 1944, she was just a few days shy of turning 11 years old. That she survived at all was due to one thing. She was a twin. Actually, it was also due to something else, her indomitable spirit. It was a quality she brought years later to the fight to tell the story of the cruel experimentation on twins carried out on her, her sister, and other children by the Nazi doctor Josef Mengele. In 1978, Eva started to tell that story, but it wasn't easy. Her rage at the treatment she'd suffered as a child sometimes turned people away. For her own mental health, she had to find a way through that rage and out the other side. Eva Kaur chose to forgive, though not absolve, those who had perpetrated the monstrous crimes against her, her family, and the other victims of the Nazi Holocaust. Graphic artist Joe Lee tells Eva's story in his heartbreaking biography, Forgiveness, the Story of Eva Kaur. The illustrations are absolutely stunning. But so is the narrative that Lee spins, as he takes the reader through Eva's childhood, her trauma in Auschwitz, her resettlement in the U.S. and Indiana, her fight to get the story of the Mengele twins recognized, and finally, her choice to forgive. Well, Joe Lee, welcome to Writer's Voice. What drew you to this story? You have a kind of personal connection that opened you up to it.
Yeah, of course, here in Indiana, Eva is very, very well known. In fact, she worked tirelessly to not only have the twin experiments remembered and known, but the Holocaust in general. And she, in fact, lobbied the state legislature years ago to make it a requirement that the Holocaust is part of every public school education. So she wanted it known. But my own personal connection that goes beyond, you know, just interest and seeing the importance of being aware of such a tragic event is my father was a World War II veteran. He served in the 3rd Armored Division of the 1st Army. His commanding general, Maurice Rose, who was may have been the only Jewish commanding general during World War II. I'm not sure, but he was certainly one of the few, and who was actually killed during the war, which was very unusual for a general officer. But my father's, part of his experience with the 3rd Armored Division was as they entered Germany, they liberated concentration camps. And my father was at the liberation of the Mittelbau Dora, which I think is better known as Nordhausen. And Nordhausen was a concentration camp, a work camp, not a death camp per se. But of course, there were so many deaths there. And when the American soldiers arrived to liberate it, I can remember my father just talking very briefly and then seeing different archival resources of the bodies and the few prisoners who were still alive, the unbelievable physical condition that they were in. And I think that from what my father expressed, that for a soldier, these American soldiers who were some in their late teens, their early 20s, and of course, for anybody to have witnessed what they saw, it made it come home to them about what the war really ultimately was about, whether one looks at causes, but the importance of what they were doing. And it was an unforgettable experience for him. And he told us about it. And as old soldiers don't rarely go into great detail about these events, he gave us enough information, my siblings and myself, to actually do further research. And before the book, I looked more into that. And there's archival footage of the liberation, and it's absolutely shocking. So just the importance of telling this story, it really had a huge impact on me.
Talking about archival footage, I mean, there's actually archival footage of Eva Kaur being liberated with her twin sister, Miriam, from Auschwitz. So it just really, it's just startling and really brings it home. Tell us a bit about Eva Kaur and your first impression of her. You saw her speak.
Eva was, had the good fortune to be a twin. And when her family was taken to Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1944, she and her mother, when one of the SS soldiers asked if the two girls who were dressed identically and looked identical, if they were twins, Schwillinge, her mother said, well, is that a good thing? Ask that. And he said, yes. And that is the only thing that kept them from being instantly taken to the gas chambers, where her two older sisters and both parents were taken. And probably within 20 minutes of arriving in Birkenau, they were gone. So her experience as a twin in the experiments that Mengele, Dr. Joseph Mengele, did on the twins and other children, and they are beyond belief that anybody with a medical degree could have done these things. And Eva, when she managed to survive the war and protecting her sister, and it gave her a purpose, a very central, specific individual purpose that they would survive. And she always wondered, in fact, the day before she died, when she was with us at Birkenau and telling her story to all the group that went with her from the Candles Museum that is located in Terre Haute, she said, even to her last breath, she wondered exactly what had been done to her and her sister. And, you know, consequently to the other children, because they were injected with substances and bacterias and all kinds of things that she had and could never discover, exactly what had been done.
Yes, and of course we have our own history in this country of experiments on people who are marginalized and discriminated against. Talk about the Tuskegee experiments, but that doesn't in any way diminish the horror of what happened to Eva. And in fact, Eva's sister Miriam nearly. Eva herself became sick. So first, I'd like you to say something about that, and then you know. When she got better, the condition that she found Miriam in, and it turned out that Miriam had lifelong problems because of the treatment that she'd received.
Yeah, Eva got really ill. And the only reason that she received any kind of treatment, and I mean, if one can call this medical treatment, she was taken to what was called the infirmary, but given almost nothing, just left there. But she was not part of the experiments for a couple of weeks that she was in the infirmary. And during that time, her sister was still experimented on and injected with things. And so later in life, Miriam developed kidney trouble. She needed to have a kidney transplant, which Eva, identical twin and always the great champion of her sister, without a second thought, volunteered that one of her kidneys would go to her sister. And through this whole process, they discovered that Miriam's kidneys had not grown, had not matured past the size of a 10-year-old's. And this is an adult in middle age whose kidneys had never grown and so could not deal with the capacity of an adult. So that was something that was done that really motivated certainly Eva in later life with her quest to find out what Mengele and his doctors had done to the children. So there are all kinds of traumas and physical, medical trauma was one of them. And then, of course, the incredible trauma of having experienced any of this, just a fraction of it would create lifelong trauma.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Joe Lee about his graphic biography, Forgiveness, the story of Eva Kaur, survivor of the Auschwitz twin experiments. This book is called Forgiveness, which is... It's really at the heart of the story and very much linked to this trauma as well. Eva went to Israel with her sister and then met an American tourist who had also actually been through the camps, and they fell in love and he brought her back to America, to Indiana. But she was gripped for years by rage, which really got in the way of many things in her life and her relationships, including when she started speaking publicly. Talk about what happened in May of 1986 at the Day of Remembrance, the Holocaust Memorial that was held at the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, it's such a pivotal moment in Eva's journey. So Eli Wiesel, the Auschwitz survivor and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, who is so important in remembering what had happened during the Holocaust. And for us, not just to remember, but to actively not forget and work against these things ever happening again. He was speaking, and you can see the footage of this, and a woman in a blue and white striped dress, broad blue and white stripes that actually in some ways echo the uniforms that the prisoners were given in Auschwitz and Birkenau and different camps, stands up and starts shouting. This is a solemn occasion. It's an occasion of remembrance, and she is just shouting and becoming more and more enraged.
What was she shouting? It's hard to tell in the video.
Well, part of it is she thought, and this is where trauma goes and where we all know that anger can go, is that she thought the suffering of the children in these experiments were being forgotten. And she had tried many, many different ways to try to get the children remembered and their very specific suffering looked at. And she did not think that that was coming across. So how fear can transform into anger. So Eva just exploded. And you can see the Capitol Police taking her out. And it's really interesting to hear one of those officers talked later that when he took her out and they were in the elevator, that he could tell that what she was undergoing was not just, this is what is happening now. But without being able to find it, he knew that there was something in her past. And there was, this was a deep, deep trauma. And so much beyond just what was occurring presently. You know, she had to find some way of dealing with this. I mean, I always think about, you know, if you don't do something with something that is very volatile and it's next to a heat source, it's eventually going to blow. And that's exactly what I think occurred there. And it was just, she needed her story to be recognized. I always think now that, you know, the phrase, which is so important, that say the names as an act of recognition is incredible in all of these horrible historic and current tragedies, is that that's how we honor, that's how we help heal. It's because if we say the names and we remember, then we can act.
And she is really actually the one who brought the attention of the world to this particular Holocaust story, the story of Josef Mengele's The Angel of Death, his experiments on the twins in Auschwitz. So, you know, what also struck me in watching that footage is how people don't accept the rage of women. I doubt if she had been a man that she would have been quite so manhandled, let's say, in that incident. And it was not the only one. I mean, she came in for a huge amount of scorn and rebuff, but she persisted. But let's get to the idea of forgiveness then, because she came to a point where she forgave the Nazis. I wouldn't say she absolved them, but she forgave them. How do you forgive the unforgivable? How did that happen?
Forgiveness, it's one of those human qualities that's a lot like love. It may be one word, but boy, it can mean so many different things. And I think it's easily misunderstood, but as she became more and more recognized as someone who had undergone not only this great historic tragedy, but the very specific torture of these medical experiments. And she went through a period where nobody wanted contact because they were afraid that what would she do? And I would say this, even meeting Eva long after these particular events that were her rage boiling over, you know, she was a very strong person. She was a dynamic, cantankerous human being who was very forceful. And I think that sometimes we get the feeling that, and especially with women, that, oh, that they are some sort of a plaster saint. You know, there's something incomplete. And she was a complete person. And she used that complete person to get her story and this other story known. So she clearly had to, as she was being invited to, finally to speak about these things, she was invited to a conference to talk about the medical ethics of what had been done, and was asked to invite a Nazi doctor to go with her.
That's pretty bizarre, don't you think?
I mean, and she just had to hear Eva tell the story. It was always with a laugh, and she would always say, and I think I quoted in the book, is that, what, I look under Nazi doctors in the yellow pages? And, you know, just the whole idea was pretty absurd. But she did manage to find a doctor named Dr. Munch, who had been a doctor at Auschwitz. He was a doctor who, to some of the prisoners in Auschwitz, was seen as an angel, because he had actually helped, and I am not quite sure, and it's kind of difficult to find just specifically what he did, but he helped keep some people out of the gas chamber. And he also refused to be involved in the selection process, but he was given a job of viewing the dead through a peephole in the gas chamber doors to see if anybody was still moving. So he did not want to go to this conference, but he agreed to do a filmed interview with Eva. And Eva asked him if he would sign an affidavit to what he had witnessed, a legal document to express what the doctors were doing and just the whole mechanism of Auschwitz and Birkenau. And he agreed to do that. He wrote it. He signed it. And Eva wanted to give him something in return. And of course, at that time, he was the only Nazi doctor who had ever signed a legal affidavit talking about the Holocaust and the, you know, this industrialized death machine that they had created. So she had this revelation as she was standing washing dishes, which I always think is interesting how, you know, the great revelations of history usually come through things like washing dishes or sitting under a tree with an apple drops on your head. It's when you don't quite expect it. And she thought she would forgive him, that was something she could do that was very personal and would be very meaningful. And as she was working on the letter forgiving him and also asking him if he would come to Auschwitz to sign the affidavit with her, translator and English instructor, a professor at Indiana State University, said, well, wait a second. He had nothing personally to do with your situation. He was there. He clearly was involved in this terrible crime, but he didn't physically harm you. And ask her, would you forgive Mengele? And it was something, even to say that is shocking. Even to repeat that is shocking. But she thought about it, and her idea of forgiveness was so much more nuanced than just like, well, you did this terrible thing, I forgive you. It was a point of salvation for her. It was a way that she could lay down this burden of anger that she couldn't find any other way. And so it was always interesting to hear Eva speak about this and to read about it and to be moved by it. It makes me think more of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa after the fall of apartheid. And when Desmond Tutu worked with Nelson Mandela, and Tutu said, you know, if we let the everything, and this justified, very justified anger percolate further. If we let it get out of control, then there will be a bloodbath. And revenge is one of those things that in cases, many, many cases, it certainly may be warranted, but where does it end? And so Desmond Tutu, he really worked with the post-apartheid government to set up the Truth and Reconciliation, which means that people have to admit, and we have to view exactly what was done. And people will be forgiven, but forgiveness does not mean exoneration. That if you have done a terrible crime, you have to suffer some penalty. But it isn't for me, an individual, to level that penalty. And it does me no good if I can't get to some point of forgiveness within myself. And she found that the more she spoke about it, there were victims of the Rwandan genocide. There were rape victims, people who had been victims of terrible crimes that came to her, and found that her sense of forgiveness was healing and saving. But it's a very controversial idea.
It's a powerful story that you tell. You tell it very much in her voice. The drawings are extraordinary. I mean, it is beautifully illustrated, powerfully illustrated. As you mentioned before, Eva actually died on the trip that you took with her to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is just something so incredibly poignant. And what was your reaction when you found out that about her passing?
You know, she herself had quite a few health concerns and had had heart surgery several months before that. And it was that hottest on record summer in Europe. And there was some question first whether she would be able to make these trips, that these her annual pilgrimages to Poland. But she was the kind of person, this is part of her dynamism, that if she had this opportunity, she was going to be there to meet people. She was a wonderful, she was just a great person to meet and was very charismatic. So we were supposed to meet her on that July 4th. We had spent the day before in Birkenau, where she talked to us on the selection platform. And then between the ruins of the gas chambers, the main gas chambers in Birkenau. And she was going to meet us at Auschwitz that next afternoon at the Auschwitz I, where people would recognize the Arbeit macht frei sign above the gate. And she would always meet her group in front of the picture that shows her and her sister from the archival footage of their liberation. And she would talk about that. And we were told she wasn't feeling very well that day, and that we would continue with our guides, these excellent Polish guides. And then it was only as we were on the bus to go back to Krakow, where we were staying, that we were told that Eva had died early that morning. And of course, we were shocked. You know, the tears flowed. But there was a strange kind of feeling that, in one sense, that as she talked about her family on the selection platform, and she read letters that she had written to her mother and father about forgiveness, that it was kind of a homecoming in one sense, that she survived. She told her story. She told her family story. She told the story of the Holocaust. And she had spent a very productive life, a very important life. And this was the last place that the entire Moses family, her family name, had been together. So it was sad, but it somehow made a kind of sense.
Yes, indeed. Well, Jolie, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, Forgiveness, the story of Eva Kaur, survivor of the Auschwitz twin experiments.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be with you, Francesca. And it's, as I've said in different occasions, I'm a translator. I've translated it into drawings and into a few words, but it's her story.
Jolie, Forgiveness is published by the University of Indiana Press. Go to writersvoice.net for links to the museum Eva Kaur founded, Candles Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Next up, Valerie Martin's new novel. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book excerpts and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio, Twitter at Writer's Voice, and Instagram at Writer's Voice Podcast. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. Valerie Martin has written a number of highly acclaimed novels, among them Mary Riley and Property. Her newest, I Give It to You, has received rave reviews. It's a multi-layered story of family, war, art and betrayal set around an ancient ancestral home in the Tuscan countryside. When Jan Vidor, an American writer and academic, rents an apartment in a Tuscan villa for the summer, she plans to spend her break working on a novel about Mussolini. Instead, she finds herself captivated by her aristocratic landlady, the elegant acerbic Beatrice Salviati, whose family has owned Villa Chiara for generations. When Jan finds she can't resist writing Beatrice's story of World War II, it causes complications in their friendship. The Guardian called I Give It to You a novel of philosophical and creative inquiry, cleverly plotted and packed with great characters. Valerie Martin, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's my pleasure.
This novel, I Give It to You, it's an unusual title, but I think it's one that explains a lot about the book. Explain the title.
Well, very early on in the book, the narrator is enchanted by the stories of a new friend about her family. And she says to the friend, you know, that's a great story. And her friend says, you like it, I give it to you. And when I wrote that, I didn't have a title for the book. And as I went on with the book, I began to see that this sense of people giving you a story and they're almost never satisfied with what you do with it is something every writer understands. And it just seemed like a fitting title because the narrator's friend is very generous and very giving, but she's also probably interested in her own privacy and doesn't realize, even though she knows she's talking to a writer, she doesn't realize that what she's giving away when she confides stories about her family and her past.
And in fact, this book really does center around a writer writing. I mean, a number of the people are writers. And, you know, the theme throughout, and especially which, of course, I won't give away, the end, it depends very heavily on that. But first, give us the setting where most of the book takes place, the Villa Chiara in Tuscany.
Right. Yeah, it's close to Siena, And it's a family villa. It's not a huge villa, but it is probably what Italians would consider it's more than a casale. It's not just a big house. It's a villa. It has grounds and it has a lot of property connected to it. It has vineyards and they grow grain there. It's a sort of combination of a few houses that I know and have seen or have read about or have stayed in. So I have a pretty clear picture of it in my imagination, but I don't think it as you read about it in the book, I don't think it actually exists where I put it.
And the family, say a little bit about the family, because the family is it aristocracy? Was it high mercantile? It goes back a few centuries. So give us their kind of their demographic of this family, the Salviati.
The Salviati. Yeah, they're Fiorentina. They're from Florence, and their family goes back in that city very far, probably 15th century, maybe even earlier. But gradually accumulated wealth and became part of the aristocracy and owned property in various parts of Italy. The great grandfather, I think, is a manufacturer interested in machinery. And when the war comes, they pretty much lose everything. So their property is cut back to just a few apartments and this villa, which used to be the summer house. So it's a family that's come down quite a ways from having been enormously wealthy and now living in sort of the remains of their property. And they're still comfortable, but they have, especially my friends, my narrator's friend, they have memories of finer days.
So first, tell us about your narrator, Jan. And I can't resist asking if she is at least partly based on you.
Well, she's writing a book about a family in Italy, so sure, she's partly based on you, on me. She probably is closer to me than most of the narrators, the first-person narrators of my fiction. You know, she's certainly a lot closer to me than Mary Riley, and she's not, I like to believe that the narrator of property is not close to me because she's really a villain. So yeah, I think of all the books that I've written, Jan as a voice to hand you the story is probably the closest to my own worldview.
And I didn't quite hear you. Were you saying, who were you saying was the villain?
Oh, the narrator of property, Manon Godet. Yeah, she's a bad girl. Mary Riley's a good girl, and Manon is a bad, bad girl. Jan's kind of indifferent. She's morally questionable, certainly, but I don't think she's particularly evil.
No, not at all. In fact, you know, the name Chiara, I think you even reference this, it evokes chiaroscuro, which in a way could describe the light and dark of a number of the characters. I mean, some of the characters are pretty dark, but and a few of them are quite light, but I'd say most of them get somewhere in the middle of the mixture.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's an accurate description.
So now, I wanted to say that the actual protagonist is Beatrice, that is Jan's friend, as she is seen by Jan, because Jan is, of course, the first-person narrator. Tell us about Beatrice.
Well, Beatrice has, in her family, she has a peculiar position because although she comes from this Italian family, at a very young age, she married an American. And she was also very interested in academics and became an American academic and has taught for many years in a university. And that's where she met Jan. That's how she met Jan. They met through a friend at one of the universities. So she's sort of betwixt and between and kind of an outsider in her own family. Everyone else always stayed in Italy, never left Italy. And she's really created a life for herself in America. So she's torn. And her marriage to the American did not work out. He was from New England. So she has a son who she pretty much raised alone. And she's raised him both in America and in Italy. So she does really occupy a kind of middle position in a family and is considered to be someone who in some ways has betrayed the family.
And yet you could really argue that the family has betrayed her.
And they definitely have. And she's the only one who's got any sense and is trying to hold on to the property and pass something on. And what's happened, and this has happened in so many Italian families, that especially since the war, World War II, they may have had five or six heirs, but they're now down to one. And that's an important plot point in the story, that Beatrice, who is the outsider, has the only, her son is the only heir to all of the estate, or he should be.
This is Writer's Voice, and you're listening to a conversation I had with Valerie Martin about her new novel, I Give It to You. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And so another thread in the book, I mean, it partly takes place in the modern day, but also partly it takes place back during Mussolini's Italy, during the war. Jan finds out very early in the book about Beatrice's uncle Sandro, who was killed during an incident at the Villa Chiara during the war. Before getting into Sandro himself, you know, World War II happened some 75 years ago, yet it still exercises a powerful pull on our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think this is so?
Well, I mean, it totally redrew the world, and people my age certainly have parents who fought in it. On my last trip to Italy, I met out on a walk an old man who was very jolly, and he started talking about the war and about the fact that he used to sing the song that was created to hail Mussolini, and that he went to the camps, the education camps that the fascists ran during the war. So it's not only is the idea of it alive, some of the people who were engaged in it are still alive. And it was so devastating for Italy, much more so than for the Americans. I mean, we went, we fought, we came back, and we got rich. They were destroyed, and so was Germany. And in some ways, they've still never recovered.
Say more about that.
Well, their economy, I don't think ever, it was blazing away for a while on tourism, but so much money was lost, and these aristocratic families that I describe, who used to employ lots of people on grand estates, just couldn't keep it up. And so that's when agriturismo started, which I guess was in the 50s. It's very clear in the book. I can't remember exactly. When people who had large houses realized that the only way they're going to hold on to them is that they rented them out to foreigners. And I thought when I first saw what was happening that this was really too bad, and almost anything would be better. But I was interviewed by an Italian radio person once, and he said, well, do you think it would be better if they built, you know, sky high hotels like the Americans do? And at least it preserves the countryside. And I thought he was right. It probably is a good thing.
And this kind of leads to another theme in the book, which is the class tensions between the manor and the peasants, particularly after World War II. You know, talk a little bit about that. And was that something that you also saw in your research that was, you know, that then you brought to life in this book, I Give It to You, this new novel?
Yeah, it definitely is a society that at one time had very clear and strict classes, and the aristocracy was large, powerful, and employed a lot of people. And the peasants really were poor and still are, lived on just almost nothing and still do. So that in some ways that hasn't changed. There wasn't a whole something you would really call an active middle class, I think, before the war. Well, I guess there was. Yeah, in fact, Mussolini probably came from it. But it wasn't anything like the American middle class, where people suddenly all became homeowners and moved out of the cities into suburbs. That did not happen. So it's a bit different, and it's still a very class driven society, as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm not an Italian, but I talk to Italians about that. I have some friends who I guess you would call the middle class. They call it the haute bourgeoisie. And they have a very romanticized idea about the poor. And they often talk about how wonderful and simple the poor are. When, in fact, my experience of dealing with various people who are employed as servants in places that you would go for agriturismo was that they're quite vicious. So
they're vicious, you said?
Yeah. Some, I mean, some, not all some, but, you know, they live a hard.
Are you talking about class resentment?
Yeah, that there is real class resentment. And it's very similar to the kind of thing you see here. I think Americans sometimes romanticize the poor and think that they're just, you know, wonderful, good people striving. Or they go in the other direction and distrust the poor, who are basically just poor people who are striving. So I think class lines tend to persevere.
So let's talk a little bit about the war. What drew you to this story? A story, well, first of all these elements are in it. You know, you have Sandro, who wants to marry a peasant, and his father disapproves of that, and then Sandro ends up getting killed when partisans come. I hope I'm not giving too much away.
No, go ahead.
Because I actually think you talk about that pretty much in the beginning of the book. But what drew you to talking about this history of war in Italy? And tell us about the research that you did.
Yeah, I think what drew me to it was a few friends who had stories to tell. The story of the Uncle Sandro, who was locked away for many years because he wanted to marry a peasant, is based on a true family story from a friend that I know. And I'd always been interested in that story, which stretched through the war. And then I think I came across the information or the story, and there's even a movie about Mussolini's illegitimate son, who he had very early on in his career. And he had the mother, who was a half Austrian woman, incarcerated in an insane asylum. And the son was named Benito Mussolini. So he had him, I guess he gave him a stipend for a while. So he acknowledged that it was his son, but then he sort of had him disappeared and put into an asylum where he died probably of an overdose of insulin, because they were doing insulin therapy at that time. So I began to think about that young man and when he was in the hospital, and about my friend who had told me about the uncle who was in the asylum. And it seemed to me that they probably were in the same part of the country and that they might have been even in the same asylum. So that really got me cooking. And I started kind of looking into psychiatric treatments in Italy. I learned that shock treatment was invented by an Italian named Ugo Cerretti in 1938, which was the same year the Jewish laws came into being. And it all started to have that sinister feel of a really good story. So I began to do more research. I read wonderful books by Iris Origo, who was a British, she was really half American, but a British woman who was married to an Italian count. And she wrote about her life in his estate during World War II. She was very, very brave. And there were times when a knock at the door might be German soldiers coming to occupy your house. It might be German soldiers running away. It might be Italian soldiers wanting to take over your house. It might be Italian soldiers running away. It was very, very strange how many groups of people were moving around the countryside and just sort of lodging anywhere they could find a place. And she also took in a lot of children who were, they wanted to get them, say, out of Geneva because it was going to be bombed by us, which it was. And so she took in a lot of children into her estate and looked after them. I think at one point she had 22 refugee children. And she walked them from one town to another. So very fascinating stories that really brought the world of that war to life for me in a way that I hadn't seen before. So then, of course, I read four or five biographies of Mussolini. I read the Ciano Diaries, Count Ciano, who was Mussolini's son-in-law, who he had murdered at one point, who was kind of a head of state and kept diaries through the whole war. Those were really fascinating. I read a book about psychiatric treatment called Great and, what is it? Great and Desperate Cures, which describes the rise of treatments like insulin therapy, shock therapy, and lobotomy. And well, then I read a book called Fascist Voices, which is letters written to Mussolini throughout the war. People really loved him. And the letters are quite revealing. And that's a good start. And that was my start.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think Isabel D'Arrigo, I think one of her diaries of the war has just been reissued, and it's on my bedside table.
Yes, it has. And it's her books are wonderful. I think she did three about the war. The first one is called The War in Valdorcia, which is where she lived. But, you know, when I'm doing research, there's a whole lot of luck and serendipity in it. I was walking down the street in the little town of Millbrook and met a friend who was with a friend who somehow the talk of Italy came up. I think they have just made a trip and it was revealed that I was a writer. And she said, well, you really must read this book by Iris Origo called War in Valdorcia. And that was what brought me to find this wonderful writer who was really one of my best sources for my research. So it's just amazing how when you're starting to look for things, they just sort of fall into your lap.
Yes, I've had that experience too. You know, this book, as I think we mentioned before, it really does revolve around writers and writing. I mean, a number, you know, of the characters are writers or would-be writers or professors of literature. Without giving anything away, talk about the tension that you alluded to before between writing about a friend and the friendship itself and how writing about them can strain that friendship.
Yeah, I don't usually do that. Although I think that probably in most of my books, there are stories that I may have picked up or heard from someone, and I may not even remember who, about an incident or a character who appeals to me. People's reaction when they know that you are a writer is always very strange. It makes them uncomfortable. And they seem to think that you are hoping that they will tell you a story or that they will become a character in your imagination. And for most part, that doesn't happen. And I don't look on people that I meet or my friends as potential material. I think Philip Roth made some famous remark about how nothing bad can happen. It's all material. You know, so there's a kind of unconscious poking around looking for stories that I think is part of any writer's relations with other people. Somebody asked me the other day, I mentioned something I knew about someone else, and they said, why would she have told you that? And I thought, I don't know why people tell me things, but people tell me things. Maybe I'm a good listener. I don't know. I think I'm actually probably not a good listener. But anyway, so that feeling that people have about you when they know that you're a writer, it's very different from if they think you might be a writer. I had to go through that for, you know, when I first started to write. The assumption is that you will fail. But once they find out that you actually are a writer, then their relationship is never, their feelings, I think, are never quite as relaxed as they would be if they didn't fear that you might write something about them.
Hmm. And even more so if you write a memoir, I would think.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk to memoir writers. That's just too close, right? You know you're going to wind up in there. It's sometimes I have actually based characters on people that I've met and known. And another thing that's amusing and it almost always happens, I think Jan actually comments about this, they never recognize themselves.
Wow. Well, that actually attests to the skill of the writer, don't you think?
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You know, when we last spoke, it was 10 years ago, you were teaching at Mount Holyoke College, and we spoke with you about your literary influences, among other things. And at that time, you listed Flaubert, Albert Camus, and Stephen Crane as early influences. I just wonder, do you still draw on those influences? Did you draw on them for this book, or have they been supplanted by other writers?
Yeah, those really were the early ones. I'll never get over Flaubert. I mean, I think he's always sort of in my thoughts. In the last years, I've been so in love with Chekhov, which I didn't read Chekhov until I was 40. And I don't know why, but it just blew me out of the water. And I think it changed the way I write his stories, particularly one called The Duel, which I read in Italy many years ago. And so Chekhov's a newer influence and a strong one. And then there's some writers whose work I just always read when it comes out. I always read Ishiguro. I always read Banville. I always read Kutsaya. So so that's a kind of the living influences. Those are just right off the top of my head.
That's great. Well, I love this book. It was a terrific read, your new novel.
Oh, good.
I give it to you. Valerie Martin, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. I'll write another book so we can talk again.
Valerie Martin is the author of 12 novels, including The Ghost of Mary Celeste, The Confessions of Edward Day, Trespass, Mary Riley, Italian Fever, and Property. You can listen to an audio excerpt from I Give It to You at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.